The Unitarian Universalist United Nations Office, or the UUUNO, is the Unitarian Universalist Association's representative at the United Nations. The UUUNO is a membership organization of individuals, congregations, and institutions in the United States and Canada dedicated to achieving a democratic world community. It is committed to peace, freedom, and environmental responsibility, as well as social, civil, and economic justice for all. The founding of the UUUNO can be traced to April of 1962. Adlai Stevenson, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations and a Unitarian, wrote to the UUA president suggesting that each UU congregation nominate an envoy. He wrote, "Let me recommend to you the appointment of envoys in UU churches to promote better knowledge and understanding of the United Nations. In this disastrous and shrinking world, it is no longer possible, if it ever was, for local communities to be more secure than the surrounding world. Our ultimate security, therefore, lies in making the world more and more into a community. All of you have the opportunity to share in the answer and thus help us build a peaceful world." Today, the UUA holds official consultative status with the UN Economic and Social Council, or ECOSOC. This enables UU delegates to attend UN conferences and summit meetings, submit position papers to ECOSOC bodies, and participate on NGO committees to affect policy concerning UN business. Canadians have been major players in the organization for many years. When the UUUNO was failing in 1996, Canadians organized a spring conference in Ottawa with high-profile speakers. This gave the organization new energy and a new lease on life. In 1998, Elaine Harvey from the Kingston, Ontario Unitarian Fellowship represented the UUUNO at a diplomatic conference in Rome. She worked for 5 weeks with Canadian diplomat Philippe Kirsch on a compromise agreement which directly resulted in a statute for the creation of the International Criminal Court. More recently, Executive Director Bruce Knotts, who spoke to us last December, was successful in 2008 in presenting the issue of rights for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender rights to a UN conference for the first time. As a result, the UN has identified LGBT rights as human rights, and this has been placed on the UN's agenda for the first time. It should be noted that people who identify as LGBT can be prosecuted in at least 76 countries abroad and can be given the death penalties in 8 of these countries. The UUUNO is the only faith-based organization fighting for LGBT equality internationally. Generally, our values as both Canadians and Unitarians mean we believe in collaborative solutions to world issues. While the Canadian government of the day may not always reflect these values of the United Nations, the UUUNO represents us as Unitarians and Universalists and ensures our voice is heard on issues of peace, freedom, and environmental responsibility, as well as social, civil, and economic justice for all.
Please take a moment to make yourself comfortable. Take a breath and another. Make yourself comfortable to receive these words. We all know that climate change is rushing toward us quickly and will have grave consequences. It's hard to keep an optimistic attitude when we seem to have no leadership to do what needs to be done. I invite you to think about something that you do to refresh your spirits and your optimism. What do you do to recharge your hope batteries? Take some time in the silence to do that to your mind. Refresh yourself. Open yourself to hope. Think about the positive things you have done to help. Think about the ways that we can put our hope into action. Let us share a moment of silence to remember those currently affected by climate change. Let us carry in our hearts those whose lives seem desperate because of homelessness, hunger, and illness. May their situations improve. May we find good solutions for the need to reduce our carbon footprint. October 21st is officially United Nations Day. Our church has always tried to celebrate by having a service around this time of the year to honor the work of the UN. The UNO office has had annual focuses on issues like GLBT rights, human rights, water rights, and this year it will be climate change. Their MO is usually in the form of an annual educational seminar, which encourages the attendance of UN member country reps. Obviously, their success varies. As John mentioned, Uganda and Russia, among others, did not learn too much from the GLBT awareness forums. Nestle did not learn too much from the water awareness forums. But we all are learning the costly lessons of climate change. I suspect that by the end of this year, hopefully, we will know more than we ever thought we needed to know about climate change. The recent UN Climate Change Conference in Warsaw was held between the 11th of November and the 22nd, so it's just finished. There hasn't been a whole lot of news because there have been other things that have taken precedent in the press. But the opening remarks emphasized the importance of de-risking the business model with high resilience and capturing the rewards of moving to low carbon, with a focus on how climate action can be seen as an engine of growth in a green economy. In our tech-savvy world, this conference promoted 12 steps to low-carbon consumption. We're doing all of them, I'm afraid. Well, not afraid, but most of them. The UN website's a very friendly place to be and very interesting. I found that I could have spent way more time than I had just rolling around and finding some new ways of reducing my carbon footprint. I'm like most of you, though, I think that I'm one of the converted. I know how threatening climate change is for us. The abbreviated news reports that we all listen to neglect to inform us of the wonderfully progressive and inventive ways that people all over the world are chipping away at their carbon footprint. So log on and find out what the UN is up to. The UUUNO has a climate change task force, and you can be a participant online, which is kind of a nice way to get your feet in the water. Climate change costs billions annually, but the trauma cost is even higher, leading to political instability, higher food prices, water scarcity, decreased water quality, property damage, loss of wildlife, ecological damage, flooding, drought, famine. higher insurance premiums, lower livestock productivity, declining glaciers, declining snowpack, stream flow decline, and heat-related illnesses. The news this week, other than what came out of Toronto City Hall, has mostly been about climate change. Typhoons, floods, hurricanes, almost enough to make you lose your appetite. And speaking of appetite, the dictionary definition of a fast is a period of time when we don't eat any food. It is a way that members of our society often choose to protest an issue important to them. The Canadian Unitarians for Social Justice have suggested that we could impact climate change if we participate in some form of climate fast. So this is really a carbon fast, reducing your carbon use. The fast is a spiritual action. It focuses the mind all day long on what you have chosen to think about. It focuses the energy toward your goal. A healthy planet and a sustainable lifestyle for humanity in relation to our Earth. When we fast, we reflect on what we must do and how we can go forward. A recent Kairos-sponsored climate fast, they called Power Down, asked participants to consider the following challenge: to take a complete day off from carbon. For most of us, that would mean staying at home in the dark, to completely use no fossil fuels. Then they sort of went down a rung and asked if you couldn't do that, you could abstain from fossil fuel use or fossil fuel-powered electricity use. So there's all kinds of levels of decreasing your carbon-based footprint. I will preface this reading that I have from Charles Bowden's Blood Orchid with the cringe that it gave me when I first read it. I thought, maybe I shouldn't give this to these folks because they're really mostly the converted. People who have chosen to believe in the seventh principle. But this may just strike a chord with some of you. So I'm quoting from Charles Bowden from the Blood Orchid. He says, "We are an exceptional model of the human race. We no longer know how to produce food. We no longer can heal ourselves. We no longer raise our young. We have forgotten the names of the stars and fail to notice the phases of the moon. We do not know the plants, and they no longer protect us. We tell ourselves we are the most powerful specimens of our kind who have ever lived. But when the lights go off, we are helpless. We cannot move without traffic signals. We must attend classes in order to learn by rote numbered steps toward love or how to breastfeed our baby. We justify anything at all, by the need to maintain our way of life. And then we go to the doctor and tell the professionals that we have no life. We have a simple test for making decisions. Our way of life, which we cleverly call our standard of living, it must not change except to grow yet more grand. We have a simple reality we live with each and every day. Our way of life is killing us." This morning, I take excerpts of the Canadian Unitarians for Social Justice Service, and I'd like to read you the words of Diana Ellis, who's a member of the Unitarian Church of Vancouver and a Suzuki elder. She asks, "What is it that transforms us? What moves us from one place of believing to another? What makes us even imagine that such a move is necessary and possible? What constitutes a call to action? And what action? What inspires us to continue once we have begun? Transformation begins inside ourselves, usually in numerous steps. Here is one story. Watch for its steps. Remember, I'm channeling Diana Ellis. Some years ago, at age 64, with life circumstances changing, and after 35 years of work on social justice and women's issues, I was wondering what was next. You know, that niggling sort of question that comes at some point in our lives. What else is there? Then in 2009, the Unitarian Church of Vancouver brought David Suzuki to speak as part of our 100th anniversary celebrations. It was a beautiful May evening. The setting sun shone in our warm, wooded sanctuary. A huge photograph of Earth, you know, the one from space, hung in the front. And David, in his iconic voice and gestures, spoke eloquently of the environmental issues and task at hand. The shift in attitude required to make positive environmental change. I remember thinking, he's talking to me. And without meaning to sound dramatic, I left that night wondering if I had heard the call. I read all the environmental books I could find. One was Canadian award-winning journalist Alana Mitchell's book, Seasick, and The Global Ocean in Crisis. She ends her stunning reveal of that crisis just at the point where I was about to close the book in hopelessness by talking about what any of us can do about it. She spoke of the transformation that needs to happen for personal action to occur, affirming that transformation is possible and always begins with ourselves. She said, we need to strip ourselves down psychologically and figure out what it is we stand for. What is the story behind the world that makes sense to us emotionally? What is it that we believe? What are we here for? Once we know that, we can start to ask the right questions, including, what's missing in my story? Answering that question leads to a course of personal action. Aha, maybe I was hearing the call, she says, to shift issues, to learn anew. And this is one of the wonderful parts of being retired, as many of you know. You can learn something totally new, and your enthusiasm seems to go up by many degrees. I marked that page, she says, and after more months of investigating environmental groups, attending conferences, and reading, I happened upon news of an elders and environmental forum sponsored by the Suzuki Elders Council. I knew I was meant to go. I did, was inspired, and everything fell into place. Now, as a Suzuki elder, she says, involved in mentoring, motivating, and supporting elders and youngers in dialogue, and action about the environment, she has a sense of the right relationship and she has many great opportunities to work with others for change. I tell you that story as an example of questioning, hearing, and responding to a call. All of you will have such stories in your lives. Again, that message. What story about the world makes sense to us emotionally? What do we believe? What are we here for? Know that in order to ask the right questions, including what's missing in my story, then move on it. Here are a few threads of consideration for you from this Suzuki elder, Diana. The planet will go on without us. The planet is not here for us. It is not our servant. Nature is not our savior, not our mother, not a partner with whom we can make a pact or covenant. Personalizing nature, making nature human with a specific gender can be a dangerous thing. It allows us to think of nature as other, something out there, something we can fix or change or control and own. 65 years ago, conservationist Aldo Leopold, with his great and quiet work called A Sand County Almanac, wrote, "Conservation is getting nowhere because it is incompatible with our Abrahamic concept of land. We abuse land because we regard it as a commodity belonging to us. When we see land as a community to which we belong, we may begin to use it with love and respect. There is no other way for land to survive the impact of mechanized man. That land is a community is the basic concept of ecology, but that land is to be loved and respected is an extension of ethics. So instead of anthropomorphizing the planet, Earth, nature, as a person, as a woman, think instead of James Lovelock's premise of the planet as a system, not outside it. As the David Suzuki Foundation's Declaration of Independence says, we humans are but one of 30 million species weaving the thin layer of life enveloping the world. One of 30 million species, and a new species being discovered every day. David Suzuki says emphatically that anyone who will listen, I guess he should say it to anyone who will listen, we are the earth through the plants and animals that nourish us. We are the rains and ocean that flow through our veins. We are human animals related to all other life as descendants of the firstborn cell. Here's another thread. We also know from reading the records of geology, geography, meteorology, paleontology, that climate change has been with us always. What we now see is the direct involvement of our human hand, knowingly and unknowingly, in the climate change upon us at this time. As thinking beings, we have the consciousness to take responsibility for our actions. And as moral beings, we have the conscience to know we need to be with each other, working together as we move through these times. American scientist Dr. Suzanne Moser writes a chapter in the Handbook of Environmental Leadership entitled Getting Real About It, Meeting the Psychological and Social Demands of a World in Distress. I find her analysis useful in thinking about that conscience work. She says, the public and elected leaders do not yet grasp the seriousness and urgency of the situation. Or, in the absence of not knowing what to do, choose to focus on more pleasant topics. Or, as we know from our recent environmental awareness campaign, people get stuck on what the press choose to headline, and it's hard for us to find what's really at issue. She says, it is in this world that some have chosen to be environmental leaders. And what is asked of these leaders? To be steward, shepherd, arbiter, crisis manager, grief counselor, future builder. It's all of these. And to do this complex and spiritual work, future leaders need not just be expert in climate change or a particular environmental field, but be capable of holding that which is happening to and in our world, to mentor, to guide and assist people in processing enormous losses, human distress, constant crises, and the seemingly endless need to remain engaged in the task of maintaining, restoring, and rebuilding, despite all setbacks, a viable planet. The only place the human species can call home. And while holding that vision, leaders must resist their own and help others avoid the knee-jerk response of ideological hardening, defensiveness, and blame. This is the compelling, deep, and exciting work. I don't know about you, but I have to say that in the midst of all of this, there are moments when I say to myself, too much reality. I'm turning off the TV, closing my book, shutting down the radio. I've had enough. Again, I don the cloak of Diana Ellis. Any of us involved in the transformative work of change need time from time to time to take the space to reflect and regenerate. And so here we are together. We don't need any martyrs. We just need participants. And in closing, I'd like to share these words of Wendell Berry. When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives will be, I go and lie down where the wood duck rests, in his beauty on the water, and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time I rest in the grace of the world and am free. Blessed be.